I'm Shamita Basu, and you're listening to The Takeaway. We're going to continue our conversation about the racist incident in Central Park by stepping back from birdwatching and talking more about, quote, white spaces in general, and how Black people are expected to navigate them. Joining me is Mickey Kendall, feminist writer and the author of the book Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot. When Mickey first saw the Central Park video, she said it was hard to process what exactly she was seeing on the screen.
Because what you're seeing is somebody lie and build the lie coldly in front of you, right? So she's not in danger. He asks her to back up. You can see that this is not really a scary situation. So it's very disconcerting to see her behave verbally, not physically, but verbally as though she's somehow scared or upset, but physically be the aggressor. And then as she's using her words, for lack of a better way to put it, building a narrative that is a threat, all while feigning fear, right? We're supposed to think she's scared, but the video shows us she's not afraid. She approaches him and gets belligerent with him. And when she tells him that she's going to call and say it's an African-American man, and you watch her voice go from angry to teary, and it's completely fake, it's such a disturbing sequence to watch. Like, my first thought was, what is this? Is this staged? And then I realized it wasn't staged. And then trying to follow the pattern in her head that made her think the video camera in front of her wouldn't reveal what she was doing.
Yeah, Mickey, I actually want to play for our listeners, if they haven't heard, exactly what you're talking about, the tone and the inflection of Amy Cooper's voice and how that changed during the video. Let's listen.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you either. I'm being threatened by a man in the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately. I'm in Central Park in the Ramble. I don't know.
So that's Amy Cooper, and there was a lot of public outcry on social media about this incident caught on camera. But I was also struck by some of the ways that people were defending her actions. Were you seeing those types of defenses? What were your reactions to that?
So it was an interesting lesson in how implicit bias makes people see what they're most comfortable with. So people said, well, we don't know how her day started. We don't know, you know, maybe she was having a bad day. You watch someone across a sequence of minutes make decisions, choices, go from calm to upset, well, really calm to rage, and then to fake fear. We watched her do all of these things, but people were saying, well, maybe she didn't mean for him to get hurt, but she told you she did. She told you when she said, I'm going to tell them it's an African-American male.
Yeah, and there is a long history, of course, of white women accusing, falsely accusing Black men of crimes. And I'm thinking of everything from Emmett Till to more recent examples like this one. How does this incident compare to other situations where white women weaponize their tears against Black people?
So the good news is that Christian Cooper was not injured. He was not arrested or harassed. Mm-hmm. The bad news is that this was a fluke. He's an outlier more often than not. And we can talk about Susan Smith, or we can talk about John Crawford, the third in Ohio, who was shot in a Walmart because of someone's false call. We can talk about, you know, Amber Geiger, who breaks into someone's house and shoots them. All of these things, more often than not, this ends in some kind of harm, whether it be an arrest and the person who didn't commit a crime being harassed by police or abused by police or losing some part of their livelihood or their good name, or worse, someone ending up dead, right? Even as we watch this playing out, in Minnesota, we saw the police kneel on a man's neck until he was dead, right? There's no guns involved because someone said, well, no one came with guns. Well, you don't need a gun to kill a man. You don't need a gun to kill a woman. And this history, even though I know Christian Cooper has since said that he didn't want her life to be torn apart, it's about Christian Cooper, but it's not really about Christian Cooper. It's about all of the people who can be hurt by this, right? We see no reports, and hopefully the police just didn't respond aggressively. But imagine if that entire scene had played out differently. And let's say Christian Cooper continued his birding, but 4, 5, 7, 10 other people who fit her description, which is a Black man in a bicycle helmet, were then stopped and accosted by police, were abused by police. Because let's be clear, if you Google NYPD and brutality, the record is there. She knows exactly where she lives. She knows exactly what she's doing.
You know, it makes me think also about who can and who can't weaponize law enforcement to their advantage. And I understand the answer here might be obvious, but what does it tell you that she decided in that moment to call the police?
The polite way to put this is that she relied on the state to do exactly what the state had always done, serve the interest of white supremacy. That was what she felt was necessary in the moment because someone had dared to challenge her internal narrative about her right to do whatever she wanted, however she wanted. Let's be clear here. She knew she could call the police and that they would do this thing. And she includes this threat to mention he's an African-American male and all of this because she's comfortable. She never has to fear the police. She's never been afraid of the cops. And that says a lot about what policing really is in America and its purpose. If you're going to argue that we need the police, who's the we? Who are they protecting? Who are they serving? Whose interests are they handling? Because let's be clear, this was about putting a leash on a dog, obeying the posted signs.
Right.
And she was willing to risk his life so she didn't have to put a leash on a dog.
Now, on Monday, Amy Cooper, this white woman, told NBC New York, quote, "I sincerely and humbly apologize to everyone, especially to that man, his family." What did you make of Amy Cooper's apology?
That wasn't an apology.
Why not?
That was Amy Cooper absolving or attempting to absolve herself before the consequences showed up. Mm. Because by that point, we knew his name. So that man, we can't apologize to. I apologize to Mr. Cooper. Secondly, to anyone I might have offended, you didn't just offend someone, you filed a false police report. You knowingly, willfully chose to file a false police report. And aside from the fact that it's apparently a crime in New York, you did so in such a way as to guarantee in your head he would be punished for daring to tell you to obey the law.
Mm.
So sure, she's sorry she got caught. She's sorry that the video went viral. I'll believe that. Is she sorry for her behavior? I have a much more difficult time because part of that apology was, I'm not racist. But you just weaponized race on video. So yes, you are racist.
Let's talk about that because as people have continued to look into this woman, Amy Cooper, some have pointed out that she's donated to recent Democratic candidates. She donated to President Obama's campaign. And some, it seems, are seeing that as a sort of cognitive dissonance, like this idea that Amy Cooper might actually identify as a liberal. What does this tell you about the white liberal identity?
I wouldn't necessarily say that she would identify as a liberal. I would say that there's a wide gap between Tea Party conservatives and literally the entire rest of the political spectrum. And so for a lot of people who I donated to Obama, it's because they didn't like his opponent. Let's start there. Then let's also talk about the fact that being quote unquote liberal throughout American history, especially in terms of white liberal politics, has never meant that you were not racist. You know, like we have a narrative that Lincoln freed the slaves. Well, A, he didn't, and B, are we really going to say he's liberal because he didn't want to keep an institution going that he already knew was going to fail? And especially when we know that his plan was then to deport everyone of color, everyone who had been a former slave. So it's not that we have this binary of either you are liberal and not racist or you are conservative and racist. It's like everything else, a spectrum. Sure, she may not be, I will burn a cross on your lawn racist. She apparently is, I will file a false police report with NYPD racist.
This incident took place in an area in Central Park, which is very popular with bird watchers, which, as we've just been discussing, is an overwhelmingly white space. How are people of color, especially black people, expected to navigate these types of white spaces?
So one of the interesting things is that you can tell that she doesn't think he has a right to be there or that he doesn't have as much of a right as she does. But in those spaces, you're somehow both supposed to be glad to be present and then defer, I guess, to whiteness. But the reality is that if we're in this world where everyone is equal and racism doesn't exist and post-racial and all the things, then everyone has a right to be everywhere. But the expectation is that somehow we accept that white people have more of a right and that they get to direct their attention to who else is there in a way as though I own this space and you have to prove your right to be here. Mm. You have to justify your presence. Right. So when we're talking about predominantly white spaces, there's some idea that white people get to police who is present, regardless of whether or not they own that space or have any inherent right to control who enters that space, and that black people are supposed to accept it, that other people of color are supposed to accept it, but especially black people and especially black men.
I'm thinking about in the aftermath of incidents like this, the emotional burden often falls on black people. What are your suggestions for how white people can better shoulder that burden and take on some of the very necessary conversations that need to take place?
I think in some very important ways, we have to be teaching white people in particular, in general, as a society, America has to start teaching anti-racism, not just as a general, don't be like the Klan, but as in a very specific, direct, and using examples like this, right? Don't be a Karen. Don't think you own the space or the right to access to a space that you don't. We kind of have to teach not to be racist, not to think you have more validity as a person than someone else because of the color of their skin. And we have to start that not at the high school or college or whatever we're currently arguing is old enough to learn about race. Black children have to learn about racism before they're even born. They experience it before they're born. They have to deal with it in the hospital. They have to deal with it when they go home. Their families have to deal with it. Mm. So should white children. They should be dealing with race and racism at the same rate as everyone who experiences it.
Mickey Kendall is a feminist writer and author of the books Hood Feminism and Amazon's Abolitionists and Activists. Mickey, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me again.